Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, when the store is quiet, I get to chat to my friends about the films and the series that we're loving. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop.
Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV?
How's it?
Hello.
Good morning.
Compliments of the season.
Yes.
Compliments. No, you said earlier that once it gets to the 7th, then it's compliments. It's still Happy New Year.
Still Happy New Year. Happy New Year, you guys. Yeah. How's it? We've got ourselves a Graham G-Force Hackney.
Hello.
We've got ourselves a Perrin P-Dog Fish.
Hello.
And you've got a Russell.
Russell needs a nickname now.
Yeah.
Actually, that's true. Why haven't we done that?
Because I'm the one that doles out the nicknames.
Yes. Yeah. Oh.
I kind of can't see you guys without your nicknames.
Okay.
So fair I'm enough. Sorry about that.
No, it's all good.
Graham, you're an editor and the producer of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Perrin, you're a jack of many, many trades in the film industry. And I am the owner of The Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg. We have been closed for the last 2 weeks to take our much-needed Christmas festive season break because otherwise the Bioscope is open every day of the year.
Yeah.
And I needed it. I got a good break. Did you guys leave Joburg?
No.
Was it glorious?
Yeah. It's quiet.
I'd imagine. And the weather was pretty good, right?
It has been pretty nice.
Yeah. Good. Mostly raining, but it hasn't been like deathly hot.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Did you get a few goofs in?
Not this year.
Hey.
Last year was wild. It was so hot last year.
The older you get without kids, the less you goof. But I've got a feeling a whole world of goofing is coming my way.
That means swimming, by the way, in case anyone's wondering.
Part of me was like,
not a euphemism.
Part of me was like, wait, what does goofing mean again? I didn't want to say anything. I was like,
I am 3 weeks away from being a dad.
Damn.
Jeez,
dude.
So yeah.
Wow.
It is imminent.
Yeah.
It is thrilling. It is nerve-wracking. Mm. It doesn't feel real.
Mm.
Every now and again, when I look at the room we've already set up for this beautiful daughter of ours, it starts tapping me on the shoulder, reminding me that this is very real. But it still feels a little abstract, which is wild. But yeah, Christmas will get exciting again within a few years' time.
Yeah, because normally, for the past number of years now, like the whole vibe for our family is like Secret Santa for everyone.
We also do that.
Yeah,
we call it the somewhat Secret Santa because someone has to coordinate it all.
Yeah, and then it's mostly for the kids now. Like we all spoil them, and it's like awesome seeing them get excited.
Yeah, no, the magic of Christmas is alive in children. It's got nothing to do with adults. Yeah. I completely misunderstood how much Coca-Cola created Christmas.
Like the image of Christmas.
In my head it was the red. Like early like European Santa Claus is more of like a thin green guy.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, and that's why Father Christmas is red, because of Coca-Cola. They created Father Christmas.
Yeah.
Did you know that? They made Father Christmas.
That's crazy.
They took a little bit of Santa Claus
from
like the fucking Netherlands and Saint Nick and all these Kringles and all of that. They made Father Christmas. Coca-Cola made it.
That's nuts.
It's nuts.
Jeez, like.
Let's talk about today.
Yes.
Because today is actually a very exciting episode.
Mm.
We are hitting the ground running with a lovely chat with you two. But also, arguably the biggest guest we've ever had.
Yes.
And I love how we're only bringing it up now.
Yeah.
No, this is very exciting. A gentleman by the name of Bill Condon is going to pop in. And I actually admire this kind of career because the work he's done is bigger than him.
Okay.
Which is quite a cool interesting place to be. I think we don't necessarily all know his name, but we certainly know the films he's made.
Yes.
He won an Oscar for the Brendan Fraser film.
Yeah, Gods and Monsters.
Gods and Monsters.
Oh.
Yes, wow. Exactly. he helmed the Beauty and the Beast live action adaptation. Yeah. So he is both the first guest we've ever had that's won an Oscar and the first guest that's helmed a billion-dollar film.
Yes.
He also, amongst many other things, did Chicago, the Twilight, the last two Twilight films, which is a very interesting thing to chat about. But his latest film, Kiss of the Spider Woman, is a film that is now in cinemas around the country, including the Bioscope. Perrin, you and I are the only ones who've seen it, hey? You haven't seen it yet, I want to chat about that.
Cool.
Especially, perhaps we can talk about Kiss of the Spider Woman after the chat. I want to talk about Stranger Things.
Cool.
Because I haven't seen it, but I know that you two have completed it, right?
I haven't.
You haven't?
Cool. Yeah, you can lead the charge on that one.
Okay, but Graham, you have. Okay, lovely. I want to talk about Marty Supreme, which is, I think, one of the big front runners in the award season. It's already been out for a week, where Perrin, you had a chance to watch it.
Yep.
Cool. It is starting at the Bioscope this weekend.
Cool.
I missed my chance to watch it as an exhibitor.
Right.
We were in the throes of our busy season. I remember sweating, setting up for this event, getting a call from the exhibitor. And I'm like, why is this guy phoning me like early in the morning? And then I saw the voice message, which was like, are you coming? And I was like, fuck, I missed my chance to watch Marty Supreme. Yeah. So I've missed it, but I know it's going to be great.
Mm.
And so we'll get into that. Cool. I think we should kick things off with a little round of Hey, Did You Guys See?
Cool.
Who would like to begin?
I'll go.
Cool.
Okay, Hey, Did You Guys See? That the Critics' Choice Awards, the results came out. The wins.
Yeah. So I'm assuming this was last night.
Yeah, it was last night.
And in many ways, I didn't actually pay attention to the Critics' Choice Award, but could we argue it's the first of the award season?
Yeah, you see more and more now, like certain festivals and certain awards are now playing big parts in shaping up what is to come.
Sure,
And Critics' Choice Award is one of the big players on the award circuit. I'd say it's
a little bit like in the film festival circuit, which happens throughout the year. Venice is famously the first. So I think you kind of want to either be the first or the last, which the Oscars has always been the last.
It's like even festival, like, so Sundance doesn't play as big of a say anymore like it used to. Telluride is a big player now in terms of shaping up what the Oscars are going to look like in the future, because that's where now bigger and bigger films are going to premiere at Telluride.
Sure, but that's at least the first chance we get to watch these films. Then they gather this buzz. And then what we keep talking about, which I enjoy when it comes to the award season, is the politics and the ideas and how these campaigns work. And it's very interesting. And I'll give my two cents now at the start. It seems like all the award winners were my picks.
Yeah,
for
same.
What these Oscars could be. So I wonder whether this could be something that happens throughout the award season.
I mean, there's been very few occasions recently where it's a different story at every... It's actually becoming more and more prominent where... I love predicting what's going to happen. And over the years, normally in the past, there would always be one or two films that would dominate these pre-shows, right? But over the past few years, there's been award seasons where it's been more scattered. Like I remember with, I think Emma Stone's, her Poor Things year.
Yeah.
It was quite scattered in terms of who won what over the season. Like it wasn't one dominant force, right? BAFTAs are becoming more playing a bigger part now on what happens at the Oscars. Usually it didn't really do anything in the past. But obviously voting, the academy, the people who get to vote, the net is getting wider now. Like, yeah. it's younger voters. It's more, it's becoming less about politics in the Oscars now and more about actual quality. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and little things like they're forcing them to actually watch all the films.
Yeah,
which
it's become,
you kind of think was part of the deal.
Yeah,
you think,
whatever. One of my biggest pet peeves was, and it was always depressing, was reading the anonymous voter ballot articles.
Right. Yeah, you've brought it up.
And it would always be so depressing. It would always be an anonymous person, obviously. And then, like, sometimes you're kind of like, is it this person? But then, like, a lot of the times they're just so cynical and miserable. And they're like, oh, I only watch this one because I hate everything else. Like,
yeah. And I voted for this because my kid liked it. Yeah. But what were our winners?
Okay, so basically the wins were the ones I predicted. Best Picture, one battle after another, yes. Yeah. Best Actor, Timothée Chalamet, his campaigning for Mardi Supreme.
Yeah, it's been wild.
The marketing blitz from A24 has been insane for that. Timothée Chalamet won that. The other big favorite for the season is going to be Ethan Hawke for Blue Moon and Vagda Mora for The Secret Agent. Best Actress, Jessie Buckley, Hamnet. Expected that just purely based on the trailers.
Yes, no, and also people's reception of her.
Yeah, and I love Jessie Buckley.
I'm very excited to screen Hamnet at the Bioscope at the end of Jan.
Yeah, cool. I'm very excited because I love Jessie Buckley, so I'm excited for that. Best Director, PTA, thank God, for One Battle After Another. I think he's finally going to win his Oscar this year.
Yeah.
I think it's realistically going to be between him, Ryan Coogler, and Chloe Zhao at the Oscars, but I don't think anyone's going to stop him. Original Screenplay, Ryan Coogler for Sinners, I expected that. Best Adapted, PTA for One Battle After Another. Stunt Design, which is, I think, is that the new category at the Critics' Choice? It must be.
I don't know.
Mission Impossible, of course.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
It just sucks that wasn't going to be at the Oscars because that's only next year.
Yes.
Best Score, Sinners, I expected that. I would have liked to have seen One Battle After Another win that. Best Movie Made for TV. Bridget Jones, Mad About the Boy.
But that had a cinema release. So that was, I thought that was a strange category.
Yeah, it's not a great slurry of films there.
It's not a nice title.
And then, like the rest is, animated feature, K-pop Demon Hunters 1, which makes sense. Little Amelie is the best film in that category, though. Little Amelie, or The Character of Rain, is gorgeous. It's a French film.
Is that got anything to do with actual Amelie?
No. It's based on a book, I think.
But all the costume and sets of that was all Frankenstein.
Yeah. Yeah.
So which we thought would be the case.
Well, cinematography was Train Dreams.
Ooh,
which I'm very happy about.
Lovely.
Jeez, I haven't even got a good choice. Why is it not giving me those categories?
I don't know.
Okay, well, read those ones.
Best Editing, F1.
Okay. That makes some sense.
Best Costume Design, Frankenstein. Best Hair and Makeup, Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Visual Effects, Avatar. Not a surprise. Best Sound, also F1.
Yeah, that definitely.
Best Score, Sinners.
Nice.
And then there's just a bunch of television ones.
Yeah.
The editing one is going to be interesting because, like, I know me and Graham have talked about this, is usually the Academy have no idea how to they pick whatever's the flashiest edit.
Yeah.
F1's editing is nuts, but, like, One Battle After Another for me had the best editing. That, like, the flow, the whole language and cadence of that film is down to the edit and the music.
Yeah.
Now.
It's a secret art.
It's an invisible art.
Yeah, so it's like it's very hard to award it.
Yeah.
Exactly. It deserves awards, but it's very hard to actually figure out what the fuck
it's hard to quantify.
Yeah. Because I mean, like, you look at an example like Bohemian Rhapsody, which famously won Best Editing, where everyone was like, what? Like, and when you notice the editing, like, it's often bad. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, whoa. It's like the problem with Bohemian Rhapsody, it was just one of those movies where everything was something happening, reaction, something happening, reaction, something happening, reaction. You know, like, oh, there's that famous scene where they are watching a performance or something. And, I can't remember, but, like, people use that. And even the guy who edited the film was shocked that he won. He was like, okay, how did I win? Anyways, yeah.
Can we move on?
Yeah.
Hey, did you guys see Brigitte Bardot died?
Yeah.
And I think what was very interesting about that is that I had a very similar experience to Chapel Roan, where okay. where I was like, oh, I own a cinema.
Yes.
Here is a famous screen actress.
Mm.
We have a classic movie Sundays channel.
Right.
And I immediately messaged Perrin and was like, should we do something? Perrin is the kind of person over here who's actually watched Brigitte Bardot films. I haven't.
Yeah.
And Perrin, you immediately responded with?
I was like, she's hasn't. Yeah, maybe let's avoid because she's a very controversial figure. Great, obviously classic screen icon of the 60s and 70s, but like, yeah, she was notoriously homophobic and racist, and it just got worse as she got older.
She leaned in because obviously her style was very cool and timeless, and she's this beautiful woman.
A sex icon.
And and so singer Chapel Roan was like, oh, she very much inspired this, you know, rest in peace. And then her very next story on Instagram was, oh shit, I had no idea. Thanks for letting me know. Never mind. Because all her fans must have gone like, whoa, hold on.
Because she was a very like staunch supporter for like animal rights and stuff, but that's where it ended.
Yeah, that's about the end of the good stuff.
Yeah, like everything else, she was like, she incited like hate, like violence and stuff like that. She was like very, a bitter person.
Just worth chatting about.
Yeah.
Do you want to speed run some trailers?
Yeah, let's do it.
Cool. How did you guys see, in fact, at the Bioscope, we saw the trailer for The Odyssey.
Hey.
Oh my God, I'm so excited.
Yeah.
But that was a very special thing.
Yeah.
So I've been waiting for the trailer to come through the channels for me to download and play in the cinema.
Mm.
But when we knew it was coming, my first question to the distributor was, is this going out on the internet on the same day? And he said no.
Right. Yeah.
So we had this weekend. Later. And we actually didn't, this is at the end of last year, we didn't actually have any screenings that were going to justify this DCP. We only had normal digital screenings and private events. So I was like, but I really want to play the trailer. So then I thought, you know what? If there's one film in 2026 that we are excited to see a trailer for, it's The Odyssey.
Mm.
And I think I can put it out on social media that for a particular window of time on Saturday, for free, obviously I'm never going to charge for such a thing. If you want to come and watch the trailer in the cinema, you can watch it.
Mm.
And you'll be able to see it before everyone else.
Mm.
And people came.
Yes.
Throughout the hour little window we created.
Like
one dude missioned from Pretoria.
What?
Just because he's like, I want to watch the trailer.
Wild.
Yeah,
so it
I'm
was
very
cool.
Excited.
Yeah.
It would have been cool if... I wonder if we can get the prologue.
Oh, right.
Because you saw that the prologue was attached to, of course, we didn't freaking get it. In America, they got the prologue before Avatar.
Yeah.
It's the first 7 minutes of the movie, and it's apparently the sequence of the Trojan horse.
Okay, because that's how it starts.
Apparently it's nuts.
Like, I really enjoyed watching some videos on YouTube over the holiday about what is actually in the Odyssey, what is in the book.
Yeah, it's the Cyclops. And
stuff so like just you can get familiar with it. It starts with Troy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's interesting stuff, man. Mm. The Cyclops, the fucking sirens, these characters. It's going to be so cool.
Yeah. So I'm excited about, because the book is very, very gruesome. It's very gory. I'm wondering how far Nolan will take that, because traditionally Nolan hasn't really ever made bloody movies.
Yeah.
The bloodiest movies made is like Memento.
Yeah, that's a grubby film in a cool way.
But like, I'm most excited to see how they do the Cyclops. Because
And you got a little inkling of something in the the trailer that we showed was a little bit more of a teaser than anything else. But you got the little inkling of that sort of giant in the cave, which is cool.
It's a typical Nolan teaser, because that's how I love Christopher Nolan films. Always have teasers that like entice you. You're like, holy crap, like, I need to know more, but also I don't want to know more. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I just love how he didn't change the font. From Oppenheimer. Yeah. Whoever was making the trailer just had the same project file open.
Yeah, he wasn't responding to WhatsApp messages. He's like, fuck it, I'm just doing.
And he was just like, The Odyssey?
Yeah.
Should we just go with this?
Yeah.
Looks good.
Yeah. Go. Look, before the trailer teaser dropped, I was a little bit hesitant because of the cast. I was like, this is a weird group of actors. Nice. But, I mean, Matt Damon is age-appropriate for that character.
Odysseus.
Yeah, it's yeah, I mean, I rewatched Troy the other day.
Okay.
And, yeah, like, obviously it's a completely different Swords and Sandals epic, but, like, it's quite, this is going to be a different beast entirely, I reckon.
But it's exciting.
Yeah, and no, we don't care about the discourse about the armor not being historically accurate.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I love that. I've only ever seen that one post.
Everyone's like, Batman's in this, apparently.
Twitter has been insufferable.
Yeah,
no, but there was
and Reddit.
I just saw one post, which is like, you know, this is how the armor differs. And then someone said, like, this is why Christopher Nolan's making this movie and not a nerd on Twitter.
not a virgin on Twitter, Because
I think that's it. We don't have to go on more about it.
Yeah.
What are the trailers?
We've got a trailer for Steven Spielberg's new film.
Shit, I still
Disclosure Day.
I just love how at one point a few episodes ago, we thought someone had revealed the names to these movies, and we were like, it's going to be called The Dish.
Yeah, you said it was The Dish. And I remember that. It's the working title.
And it's the same as the Inarritu film. We were like, it's going to be called Jade or Jude, or we had some other name for it.
Now,
I don't
Digger.
Know where the fuck we got that.
That's a cool trailer as well. Yeah. Like, gives me absolutely nothing.
So Disclosure Day is coming.
Yes.
It's an alien invasion or alien arrival.
Seems to be something
like that. We don't know. But yeah, it's cool.
Stacked cast. Looks great.
Nice biggie.
Yeah. Spielberg hasn't done anything in a while, so it's always exciting for him to.
Yeah,
and John Williams is coming back. John Williams is going to be scoring it.
Okay, yes.
Despite the fact that he had retired, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But he's back for at least one more.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Jeez, how old is he? He's in his late
90
80s.
Something.
Yeah, flipping hell.
And he's one of the most nominated.
He's won the most, I think, Oscars as a composer. He's won
six, as a composer, definitely.
Or like five, yeah.
But just by nominations, I think he is the most nominated.
Yeah, he is. He's gotten pretty much nominated for everything he's done.
He's got like 60 nominations. Yeah. It's like
something
crazy. Silly.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other ones?
We got a trailer for Supergirl, which looks fun.
Yeah.
Cool.
I think it looks pretty cool. I like the vibe. I like the style. It's different enough from Superman.
Mm.
Cool.
And it's not, everyone keeps talking about it like it's a James Gunn movie, but it's not a James Gunn movie. But it doesn't matter.
Who is
going
to direct it?
Oh, I can't remember the guy's name.
Not James Gunn.
No, it's not James Gunn.
Okay.
Obviously, he'll produce it, but.
Yeah, do you have any more trailers?
I don't think so.
Well, we can touch quickly on Digger, which is the new Inarritu.
Yeah.
What's his first name?
Jose Gonzalez Iñárritu.
Iñárritu.
Yeah.
He had a great little run about, 5 years ago?
Yeah, I know. He's...
Where he was winning Oscar after Oscar. Well, his films were doing well. Like Birdman. What was the other one?
Revenant.
The Revenant.
Yeah.
So
Alejandro Gonzalez.
Alejandro Iñárritu. And this is his new film with Tom Cruise, which is exciting because it'll be cool to see Tom Cruise not in Mission Impossible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he's always been a really great character actor.
Yeah. Underrated character.
Completely
actor.
Underrated. Very much, when you think of
Tropic Thunder,
Magnolia.
Yeah.
I heard something very cool quickly about Magnolia.
I think I know what you're going to talk about. Yeah.
Was about the campaign around it. You know, his character was this motivational speaker.
Yeah.
They made like a fake ad.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And they
played call it. In. You could call in as well.
Which is just so smart.
That's I know he like...
What is it? Tame the...
Yeah, tame the pussy. Yeah,
something harness the horrible. Vagina or something.
Yeah. Just the story about how that character came to fruition is that PTA wrote it in a specific way. And that famous opening monologue for Tom Cruise where he's doing his sermon to these flipping incels. he was like, he actually did... So Tom Cruise is famous for loving, like he loves to learn about the craft, right? So like famously early on in his career, he would like study the lenses. He would make sure that he knows everything there is to know on a film set.
Yeah. Sure.
So that when it's happening, he can help. And that's why a lot of people love working with him, is because right. he knows what goes into all of it, right?
Yeah.
So with Magnolia, he invited PTA over to his house. He's like, listen, I want to like, let's like do this monologue together. I want to show you what I think this character is. So he was like, okay. So he did the lighting. He did that whole sequence in his little own private cinema at his house.
Right. Mm.
And he did the whole thing for PTA. And obviously they eventually wrote the final monologue together.
Right.
But like PTA credits that entire character to Tom Cruise figuring it out entirely. Like
yeah,
he was the
cool.
one who like pushed that type of character. And it works so flippin' well.
And despite being a very long movie with lots of different characters
yeah.
and interweaving stories, Tom Cruise's character really stands out,
yeah.
but he only really has like two or three scenes in the movie. Like
yeah.
There's not a lot of Tom Cruise time.
Yeah.
But every time he's in that movie, it's an amazing movie. I must rewatch
it. It's
yeah.
so freaking good. That deathbed scene is just yes, like he should have won an Oscar for that. Like yeah. incredible. But he's got his honorary Oscar now, which is
yeah,
cool.
yeah, that's true.
But Digger, what I like about that trailer is it gives us nothing. It's
literally
just,
nothing.
It's just him. We don't even see his face. We just see a silhouette.
But people actually didn't even call it a trailer. They were like, this is a name announcement.
Yeah.
Like it's not even, don't even consider this a trailer.
Because yeah, it's just a silhouette of him where it looks like he's balding and overweight or
yes.
something.
But do we know what it's based on?
So as far as I know, from what I've read, is that it's about one of the world's wealthiest men that decides to do something to save the world or something.
Okay, like, is it an original screenplay?
I think it's an original screenplay. Yeah. It's a comedy of catastrophic proportions, is that what they're describing it?
Okay.
So yeah, I'm excited to see what we get from it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very curious.
Hey, did you guys see, it is almost 100 years since Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
We should.
And ironically,
that.
We are now in 2026, in the year that the movie is set.
Oh, yes.
That's cool.
That is
cool.
Wow.
So I think it is worth
great
a
movie.
Screening.
Jesus.
I think it's I
long.
Watched it yeah,
it's
one afternoon
long.
In film school and probably slept
yeah, it's
through the middle
long.
Of it.
Yeah.
But it's always interesting to see someone's prediction of the future,
yeah.
especially if you are living that year. Like last year being the year that the movie Her was set in.
Mm. Mm.
And apart from the very cool fashion and laptop screens, it's pretty much bang on.
Mm.
Like we basically have our own Scarlett Johansson to keep us company
yeah.
if we wanted it.
Yeah, and there are people that are mentioning that, like, I remember there was like, because you get AI girlfriends now.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
And like, guys
yep.
proposing to their AI girlfriends.
Yeah.
And she said yes. You know?
Oh, God, I'm not seeing that.
Yeah,
I'm certainly seeing the ads for the girls.
Mm-hmm.
That gets fed to me.
Good Lord.
Yeah, no, and it's like, I'll do whatever you want. And you're like, oh, my God.
I'll say yes to marriage proposals.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Okay. I think at this point,
yeah.
we should get ourselves a visit.
Yes.
From Bill. I wanted to just mention that in the throes of my incoming fatherhood,
yeah.
When I got the call from the distributor to set up this chat, I was very excited and I just went, yes, 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 cool. Because this is what I have wanted to be pushing with these distributors, that when you get this kind of press junket moment with these big actors and people, like a lot of South African press do get a chance.
Yeah.
You just get 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15. It all depends on this person's time. And I've always just said to them, please, can the video store be included in this?
Yeah.
Because I want to do this more and more. Because we've got this lovely format, which is you popping in for a visit to our video store. So that could be an hour-long chat, as you know, from our guest chats, or it could be this short 5 minutes, which we had with people like Sholto Copley
yeah.
and a few others. And you can use that 5 minutes quite interestingly to go, well, what are you returning?
Mm-hmm.
What can I rent for you? And so we can hopefully be something a little different. But I went, yes, yes, yes. And then I realized it was very tight. around a scan with the gynecologist for the baby. And so I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
So I started this conversation with my lovely wife of like, so I have this opportunity. I've been pushing for a particular thing. But it actually worked out. Video Vision, which is the owners of the film in South Africa, who are releasing through UIP,
right.
Set up these chats, and they were very cool about moving my slot to make it work. So this visit comes shortly after a scan with the baby.
Right.
So that just puts into context the start of this conversation.
For sure.
Okay. I think it's worth mentioning just so that everybody understands. And then the other thing I want to just mention beforehand is that I knew an exciting project that Bill Condon is working on next is a film about Paul Simon and the album Graceland and his relationship with Hugh Masekela. Mm. So I was very excited to talk to him about this because this could mean quite a lot. And it's quite a lovely link to South Africa.
Yeah.
So that is a film that I was aware of coming up that then... you know, will come up in the chat.
Cool.
Awesome. So I just wanted to give someone an understanding because I don't think we talk too much about it and then we just launch into this chat about this film.
Yeah.
So I wanted to just give everyone, you know, a whole bunch of context here.
Cool.
All right. Should we do it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. This is Academy Award winning director Bill Condon popping in. Hey, how's it, Bill?
Hello, Russell. Russell. Congratulations. This is exciting. When is the baby?
What are you congratulating me on?
No, see, just
yes. We just had a look at her now. The timing worked out perfectly. Thanks for the guys at Video Vision accommodated me, which was very nice of them.
No, that's great. That's thrilling. And tell me, the cinema that you run, are we gonna play there?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes,
good.
Very much so.
Great.
We are taking a little break, which we do around Christmas and New Year.
Yeah.
A lot of people in Johannesburg leave, including me, to take a well-deserved break. But as we come back, we're going to open with Kiss of the Spider-Woman.
Great. That's exciting.
So it's all very good and very exciting. And so welcome to the video store. Thank you for wandering in. It is so exciting to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We've been lucky enough to have a few Emmy winners. A few South Africans have won some Emmys. Okay. But you are our first Oscar winner.
Oh, that's cool. That's nice. That's great.
And you are also the first person we've interviewed who has helmed a billion-dollar movie. Which is incredible.
Oh, wow. That's funny. Wow.
And so one of the questions we love to start with is whether or not you've got any film you'd like to return to our video store, which is something you've watched recently, a film or a TV show that sticks out to you that you'd want to return to the video store.
Well, you know, this season, we get to see all the good movies, right? So, I mean, there are a few of them. Surat, I just saw. I just love that film. Thought it was really extraordinary, Spanish film. But, you know, I'll mention one, Peter Van Kant. It is, to me, when I think of video stores, and by the way, I have a huge collection. So this is something, I'm very happy to be in a video store, even virtually, because I've spent a lot of my lifetime in there. But, you know, that's a little movie made by a wonderful French gay director, François Ozon, who's very prolific, you know, who, you know, did, you know, that film was maybe from 3 years ago. It was a remake of a Fassbinder film, Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant. But it reminds me a little of Spider-Woman. It's sort of like it all takes place on one set. It's kind of like a play, but it's hilarious. It's short. And it's one of those movies that I turn people onto, and I think they're always kind of relieved, you know. And he just did a movie this year called When Fall Is Coming, also a very good movie. He's a wonderful director.
So what is the name of that film?
Peter von Kant.
Okay, lovely.
Yeah.
Okay, what a treat.
Yeah.
And so, as we were saying, we're going to hit the ground running next year with screenings of Kiss of the Spider Woman.
Yeah.
I have loved hearing you talk about it, and I'd be curious to know when, because it sounded like it came together relatively quickly near the end, but when was that first moment when you felt that, you know, it was a book, it had been a film in the 80s?
Yeah.
When was that moment when you felt, not only does this movie need to be made again, but it also needs to be a musical?
Yeah. Well, it was when I was writing the script for Chicago, actually. Imagine that, because that's almost, you know, what is it, 20? I was writing it 25 years ago. But, and I've, as you know, you can imagine, I love the genre. I've worked in a number of times. It wasn't my idea to make it a musical. It had been a musical. It was a musical that opened on Broadway and won a Tony Award in 1993. But it's by Kander and Ebb, the composers of Chicago and Cabaret. And it did feel to me, you know, there aren't that many stage musicals that should be movies, because it is a very, very different form, you know. But this one, because it was about someone who fantasized about movies, it felt like this has to be a movie. Musical. It just felt like it was an obvious, you know, kind of part of the Kander and Ebb trilogy with Cabaret in Chicago, of characters who just have very, very difficult real lives, and they try to survive them by imagining, you know, by kind of having these show business dreams that make them, you know, sort of it make it easier to get through their day, frankly, you know. So I think that was the first impulse. And then I went back and read the novel, and I thought, my God, he was onto stuff that it's taken us all this time to catch up with, you know. It really...
Well, what were some of those things? I mean, one obvious example is Yeah?
Yes. I think that idea that Molina in the novel says he doesn't consider himself a homosexual, not interested in other homosexual men. He's a woman who's looking for a real man, you know, and that it's so there was this proto-trans idea that was in there, you know, and, you know, hadn't been dramatized yet. Also, the fact that it's not a transactional kiss, you know, it's that, but that the relationship between these two characters is a love story, you know, and that,
yeah,
is a really revolutionary idea, and it doesn't have anything to do with sexuality. That's the thing that's most revolutionary, you know, that if you take freedom away from two characters, and you also, you know, place them in this kind of, you know, daily existential crisis, will they survive until the next morning, that it forces people to start to connect to each other as individuals.
Totally. And there was definitely the feeling that the other character, not Melina. Sorry, what was the character's name? The other guy,
Valentin. Yes,
Valentin. That he wasn't necessarily gay. That was my take from it. Is that he just had the opportunity to love this person?
That's right.
And it was this love is love person thing. So it just was about their connection in this space.
Russell, I'm so glad. I'm so glad you said that, because it's a real misreading to think that what happens between them then means that we put a gay or bisexual thing on him. That's not what it's about, you know.
Yeah. Interesting, but I could tell that it was a deeply personal film for you.
Yeah,
and that you were able to make it in quite an indie way.
Yeah.
Because one of your films recently is the one that I touched on, which is this $1 billion Beauty and the Beast film. I mean, the differences between those two must have been insane in terms of how much pressure was on you. Did you feel like for Beauty and the Beast, there was an incredible sort of weight or sort of eyes on you in a way that Kiss of the Spider Woman was completely different?
They're different. you're absolutely right. It didn't feel, it wasn't so much pressure, you know. First of all, Beauty and the Beast was the first in that cycle, right, of live action remakes. I mean, they're of the musicals. It was the first.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, yeah. You know, when I think back on it, I never thought of it as a children's movie. You know, I wanted to find, and there was nobody who was sort of saying, oh, let's put kiddie stuff in or let's make it sillier. That never happened, you know? So I think the pressure is more, it's just a different style, right? Because that's a movie where there are so many visual effects, right? 2000 visual effects shots. So as you're shooting, there's that slight lack of freedom because you're kind of stuck into, you know, you pre-visit and you do all that prep work, but then when you come to shoot it, you really have to shoot it in the way you planned it, you know, and stuff like that. So yes, yeah. But it wasn't any kind of onerous, oh, Disney's on my back thing there, you know, it really wasn't.
Yeah, good, yeah.
But here, you're right. This was just like, no, and it's scarier in a way. The pressure is, there's sort of a greater pressure when it's only, you've got to live up to this thing that you, that is so personal, to make sure you're making the best version. It's not like you're answering to anybody but yourself. And that can be, that can.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That was the complete opposite of what I thought it would be.
Yeah.
I must say, just on Beauty and the Beast, you are 100% correct in saying that it is the highest grossing live action adaptation, because The Lion King is not live action, and we've debated this. We've debated this on the podcast.
Yeah, it's an animated film. Right? There wasn't.
It's so funny. All that did was just show you just the level of visual effects we are able to achieve. Yeah. No animals were harmed in the making of that. It's lovely.
No, it's fascinating. Yeah, yeah.
I see that. Although you've come from a horror start and a horror background, that almost from the beginning you wanted to inject a musical into that sort of first film you did, right?
Strange Behavior. There's a party scene, and there's this song I loved called Lightning Strikes, and I said to the director, like, I think this should be fun to do it as actually choreographed. And it was such a freewheeling experience. And he said, sure, go do it. So I got to direct that scene, you know, and I rehearsed it, and it was very fun.
What is the magic of musicals for you?
You know, I think it's that thing of the extra emotional lift that you get when, you know, it's one thing often in a musical, people, you break one of the first rules of filmmaking, right? Which is, people are not meant to reveal the subtext, to tell you how they're feeling. You're meant to just dramatize that. But sometimes when people tell you how they're feeling, like when in this movie, Melina sings about being a woman, or in Dreamgirls, where Jennifer Hudson sings about the fact that losing this man is something she just cannot let happen. You know, it's the end of her life. The emotional kind of concentration that music brings, just to me, I love that experience of being blown away, you know, and people get it from Marvel movies, right? You get it in a lot of different ways, but I guess this is my own personal drug, you know, so that I keep chasing.
But it's interesting that you're the drug dealer. It's one thing It's one thing to be in the magic show, which is what I always kind of refer to as, you know, the success of these kinds of movies, where you can be entranced, but you seek out to sort of create the drug.
and then consume, believe me. Yes.
And can it be as effective for you if you're the one manufacturing it? Can you still find the joy in it, I guess, is the question.
And the answer is yes, 100%, believe it or not, yes.
What is your most favorite part of that process, of that musical process?
You know,
if I had to just put you in one of the days of production, where would you choose to go?
Well, those are two different questions, because my favorite part of it is when you put it together, you edit it, and I, you know, in the apartment here, I have a drop down screen, and I start testing the movie the a week after it's shot, and you have an assembly. I have people over, you know, and that first that thing of seeing, especially with a musical, seeing how the musical numbers are landing, if they're landing, if you get people excited there, that to me, that part, honing that is really my favorite part of the process. But in terms of what was a favorite thing on the day, I think it was, we have this huge kind of very stylized red set that's meant to represent a kind of club, you know, and Melina describes it as it, you know, it's the color of sex, and it sort of reflects her. He says, it's all the psychology I need, you know, but Jennifer Lopez in as this little spot of green against all that black and white and red, dancing from in four different sections and doing it all in one take. You know, I cut it up a little in the film. It was just like something I'd never, ever seen before. You know, and you really, you know, it's great. There are pictures, you know, the set ends and then there's all of us shooting it, you know? And it was like, wow, this is like what a Singing in the Rain set must have felt like, you know? It's vast, but then it's also it on a stage, you know? So it really, you had a pinch me moment of like, oh, wow, I'm back in 1950 in California, in Hollywood, in MGM or something, you know?
Totally. No, and you definitely get that feeling, because when I was watching it, I was paying attention to your pacing and the editing. And I did notice that it was different.
Yes.
And it wasn't as quick and as, you know, intense. And it was cool hearing an interview where you were saying how that was very specific, so that it looked and actually felt like they once made, you know, those Hollywood pictures.
Yes, we tried. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I thought that attention to detail was lovely. Growing up in New York, you obviously had access to Broadway.
Right.
Were you able to see some plays?
Absolutely. Starting from a young age. And then I went to high school and, you know, you find your own tribe. And we were all theater and movie lovers, but mostly theater lovers. And so there you are as a 13-year-old on a Wednesday, you know, at 3 o'clock, racing down to see the second act of a show you'd already seen, you know, and you sort of sneak in and things like that. You know, we were like,
the second act sneak. Yeah. It's making little Bill Condon's.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. I think if they knew that little kid was going to, you know, go on to give us, you know, such incredible musical films, I would have let you in. we go through, and of course, if you and I had a little bit more time, we would go through this, but maybe we can touch on one or two, which is The Great Loves, which we talk about with a guest at the video store, which are the films that have come to you at certain points in your life.
Yes.
The very first one we call the Puppy Love film, which is, you know, when you're just so young, but it sort of sets a little blueprint. Could you perhaps think of a film that came to you sort of as your first film that you ever loved?
Absolutely. There's no Bonnie and Clyde, which again, I'm at 11 or 12. And so I'm sneaking in, right? Again, I'm paying for it, but somehow they let me in or they didn't care. It was my local theater. And there was something about, you know, I don't know if you remember, but the actual titles of the movie, the, you know, Warren Beatty's name would come up in white and then it would bleed red, right? There was something about that movie, the sexiness of that movie, and then the violence of it and the humor of it. I don't know how much of it I really grasped at that age, but I saw it 7 times, you know? So that was, there's no question, that was the one that really...
Did you grow up in the city?
I did. Well, in Queens, which is a borough of Queens. Yes, yeah.
Sure. Was there a cinema there that you can remember going to? What was it?
Well, there was a local one I could walk to, the Deluxe Theater, but then... you know, there were, you know, at that point, there were still movie palaces in the boroughs, you know? So, there was the when you go to see a big movie, it was the Elwood, you know, which was more a bus ride away, you know? And obviously I would go into the city too, as much as we could, you know, when we'd go see, you know, The Sound of Music, that's where you'd all dress up and you'd have your reserved seats and you'd go and it was like going to see a play, you know?
I had a lovely exchange program at the university that I was at with NYU, where these kids came every year, and I always made a point to get to know them. And then I did a few trips to New York where I was like, okay, guys, I've shown you around Joburg. Now's your chance to show me around.
Yes. Oh, my God.
And I also did one trip once I'd already started the Bioscope, and it was about a month in New York, also staying on all the friends' couches, where I pretty much went to a cinema site every day.
Wow.
And that's what's so special about New York, is that you can do that. And I watched a bunch in different places, and this was the start of like the sort of Nighthawk type cinema, where there was a bar and food. And that was very much, it's so cool because I could get some ideas for the Bioscope, but also some validation, because a lot of that was what we were already doing. And so it's a very inspiring city.
Say that's why I'm so excited that we're going to play there, you know, because I do think that is kind of the future for independent films. I think it's really like community driven in a way, you know. And I think it's harder just to be in that kind of space where you go into just normal theaters, you know, sort of traditional commercial theaters. Say you're independent, but there's a disconnect, I think, you know. So that's why I think what you're up to is so important, you know.
Yeah, thank you. And there's also just kinds of movies, and I would certainly put Kiss of the Spider Woman in the same category, which is you almost don't want to, and no disrespect to all the other cinemas, but you don't want to walk through a shopping mall and watch this kind of movie. You want to
doesn't make sense.
There are those movies that you want to be in. We're in this lovely little neighborhood. There's fountains and trees. It's very unique to Joburg. We tend to have lots of shopping malls and lots of parking lots in Johannesburg. Yeah. So we're quite special in that sense.
I'm very hopeful of getting to Joburg this year to make a movie. So I will definitely be showing up at your theater if that happens.
That is amazing, because that is something I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
Are we underway with this film? The cards.
It is. It's almost underway. It's underway to this degree that Taubo Ramezzi is, playing Hugh Masekela, is taking trumpet lessons, which is great.
Okay.
And has been. So that feels. But no, it's always just that one bit of little bit of funding, little bit of casting that we're still. Final little pieces need to fall into place, but remain very, very hopeful about it for this year.
It's a very unique and interesting story.
Yeah, it is.
And I would love to share a little moment with you, which is one Christmas, probably in the 90s, I got given a tape deck Walkman. And moments after unwrapping it, it was like, well, what can I listen to now that I've got this tape deck Walkman? And Graceland got picked.
Yeah.
And as a little kid who grew up to be a drummer, be more rhythm section, be emotional and go to art school and open a cinema, hearing Graceland for me and kind of feeling this instinct to dance, you know, when you sort of hear the boy in the bubble and
oh my
big,
God,
you know, floor toms and just going like, what is this? that album has become significant for me. Yeah. You Can Call Me Al, I was telling my wife the other day, I was like, oh yeah, this is my favorite song of all time.
Yeah, I know.
I can confidently say.
No.
But it has an interesting story where it's one of those things where it's funny to look back now at this idea of almost cultural colonization.
Yes.
But people were quite emotional about the fact that he came and made this album and left and sort of took the sound. But I think he launched, you know, some incredible musicians' careers. He opened the sound and brought that to the rest of the world in a way in which it might not have, or not as quickly have gotten out. So there's this beautiful net positive, but there's a very interesting
sort of hence good drama, because, you know, that's what's interesting. I think in our telling, both of those things are true. It is true colonization, appropriation, and yet it is also something that brought that music to the rest of the world. So it's having those two opposing ideas at the same time. I think that's what's part of the fun tension in the film, you know?
And have you written that?
I have not.
Is it?
A journalist called Michael Bronner has written it. I've been working, he started about 6 years ago. I've been involved for about 4 years, you know, and it's a complicated script. You know, we keep refashioning it because it takes place across time. And obviously, Hugh Masekela is actually the lead character more than Paul Simon, you know.
Okay, because I actually didn't know that he had such a big part in the story. I mean, I know he performed on the albums, but was he the most vocal about it?
Well, he's the one who, you know, he organized the tour, which is really where Paul Simon was going to be boycotted, you know, and it was the tour that that really brought everyone together again, you know. So it's mostly about that. And he'd been he'd known Paul Simon, you know, and sort of turned him on to the musicians, or, you know, before the album had even started, you know.
Well, because you had a video store, I would love to give you something to rent that you can walk away with. And so I hope this is something that you haven't seen, but there is a lovely documentary called Amandla.
Oh, yes.
Revolution in Four-Part Harmony. You have seen that?
Yes, I
have. Okay, then I can't rent that to you if you've already seen it. Have you seen Under African Skies?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then it was today was about you returning. Maybe exactly. We should rent you some nice South African other stuff. We'll have to have a look.
I'm sure, yes.
But if you do certainly find yourself in Johannesburg,
mm-hmm.
we are the Bioscope, which is perhaps a unique word to you. Have you heard that term?
Bioscope, no, oscilloscope, so, right.
So if you were to go to Amsterdam in the Netherlands, you'd see that it's the Dutch word for cinema.
Oh, wow.
But when I was growing up, it was quite an uncool word. It would be something that, like, maybe your grandmother said in the 80s or 90s to say, "Oh, you're going to the bioscope?" And you'd say, "No, it's the movies, man. Like, it's not the bioscope."
Oh, wow.
And when we were these film students looking to start a cinema, we naturally were like, well, the word bioscope has to be in this name. We have to bring back this kind of thing, because there were many of them across Joburg. And they all closed. They all shut. I only knew a world that was shopping mall multiplexes.
Yeah.
And so when we were thinking of the name, we realized the URL The Bioscope exists. And so we'll be The Bioscope.
Great.
So
that's great.
Having you potentially in the country, I'd love to show you around our beautiful neighborhood and we could perhaps present some of your films or have a special discussion. It could be a real treat.
I would love it. And the fact is, well, I'm there because it's going to be mostly in Johannesburg. No, it's not half and half. But I'm sure I'll just wander there on weekends anyway, just to see what you're showing, because there's nothing I love more. Yeah.
Yeah, lovely. And we got the chance to have Hugh Masekela give us a visit at the Bioscope.
Oh, wow.
I think you'd appreciate this. There was a short period when we had our own Rolling Stone. There was an official South African Rolling Stone magazine, right. And they put him as the front cover of the first edition. And that was shot just behind the cinema.
Wow. Oh, that's great.
So it was very cool to meet him for what became, you know, quite an iconic moment for South African music at that point.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's great.
But yeah, listen, okay. Thank you, Bill. I don't want to take
thank you,
any
Russell.
More of your time.
Good luck with the
it
bird.
Was a, yes. It, thank you. Yes. It was such an honor to meet you. And,
oh, it's fun.
And perhaps in real life at some point soon would be a real treat.
Hope so. Great. Okay. Later.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Yeah. Great dude.
Seems like a really nice guy.
Solid.
Good chat. Yeah.
Solid dude. And like something I love from just watching other interviews with him as well, because I try to get as much of a sense of what just at least a few other people have asked him and how he reacted and how I could maybe phrase some of these questions differently. I loved hearing him talk about the Twilight films.
Right.
And how he was like aware of how campy and silly the subject matter was.
Exactly.
And how he, I think, left enough space for it to be taken seriously, but enough space for it to be a bit spoofy.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it kind of is that.
And we all seem to understand the audience.
Yeah.
Like who Twilight is for. Like he really got that.
Mm. No, and I think he's been an interesting person in terms of a queer voice.
Yeah. Mm.
Because he's never, Kiss of the Spider Woman, and I want to talk to you a little bit about it, Perrin, obviously has big queer themes in it. But you forget that when Beauty and the Beast came out, one of the spoken about things was that this character, the more tubby dude that was the sort of side character
LeFou.
Of... What's his name?
LeFou.
LeFou.
Josh Gad's character.
Josh Gad's character was going to be sort of identifying as homosexual, which Disney had never had at that point.
Yeah.
So he just like kind of weaved it in, not made a big deal about it. Obviously, it was a little topic of conversation at the time, but it was not a big fucking deal.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
So I think he's done some interesting stuff in that regard.
Yes. I like the dynamic there. I think it's interesting that Josh Gad's character is quote unquote gay, and then Luke Evans's character is like super hetero. He's what's the character's name? Gaston. But in real life, Josh Gad is straight and Luke Evans is gay.
Yeah. That's true, yeah.
Oh, lovely. I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
What did you think of Kiss of the Spider Woman?
All right, so I mean, this is a musical adaptation. I think they did a Broadway version of the original film, which is an adaptation of a book.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I actually forgot in my nerves.
Yeah.
In my nerves of talking to the chap, I forgot that there was the musical play. Because so it was a book first, then it was a film in the 80s.
Yeah, which William Hurt won an Oscar for.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
He plays the gay character in the film.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then it was turned into a musical.
Yeah.
A stage musical. And now this is effectively the film adaptation of the stage musical.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. So it's almost like a Wicked scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, so essentially what it's about is it's set in this. So I haven't read the book. I've watched the original film the first adaptation. And it was set in a, like, it could be any Latin American country.
Yeah.
Because obviously during a phase in the 70s and the 80s, pretty much all of South America was run by dictatorships, you know.
Well, still to 2025,
where
we've got
Trump's
dictators that have
Venezuela.
Been.
Oh,
yes,
we're in a prison.
Yeah.
In this case,
Argentina.
Argentina.
Yeah.
And it's not too far in period. It was like
This is set in the 70s, right?
70s, 80s. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So basically, what it's about is that there's these two prisons. Two people that share a prison cell. One is a revolutionary freedom fighter who's been like serving time now.
Okay.
And his cellmate is a queer, I think a window dresser or something. And they share this bond, but the queer cellmate is spying for the warden.
Okay.
To try to get more information about who this guy worked with, his associates and stuff like that.
Right.
And obviously, because of this, the cellmate gets special privileges and stuff like that. And through their time together in the cell, the queer cellmate is basically helping them escape from the doldrums of this prison cell by talking about one of their favorite movies.
Right.
And it's Kiss of the Spider Woman.
Yeah.
And essentially, that's the escape in the film. A lot of the film doesn't feel like it's taking place in the prison cell because they're in this fantastical world where they get to escape.
Okay.
And of course, everything that happens in that movie mirrors what's happening to them in their lives.
Yeah.
And what they want to see in their lives is now taking shape. You know what I mean? And Yeah, so I like the original film. I thought William Hurt is phenomenal in it. And it's also famously got the father in Adam's Family. What's the actor's name? Raul something.
Raul Julia.
Yeah, he was in this as well. I think he got an Oscar nomination as well. But yeah, this obviously musical version, Jennifer Lopez plays the Spider Woman in these fantasies and another character in that movie. And yeah, I mean, look, it has been getting mixed reviews. I didn't think it was as bad as people said it was. I think it's got a lot of good positive moments. I think the character who plays the gay, the actor who plays the gay cellmate, blanking on their name, let me get it now. I thought they were the shining light of the movie. Okay. I thought they were really good.
Yeah, it was interesting to see what kind of a role this was for Jennifer Lopez, because she really wanted this to be her big kind of critical darling of a film.
Right.
But what she really plays is nothing much more than a music video character, because she performs incredibly and very... It was really cool to see Bill Condon sort of talk about her, that she really showed up. She learned all these moves and her dances and could sing and was very professional and very like on it. And they did a lot of these in kind of one big takes. He wanted to film this like a real Hollywood picture.
Right.
You know, where it wasn't fast cut.
Yes.
And so it does have a different pace to it. And I noticed that. And then it was very interesting to hear him say, and I think we spoke about it in the chat, the fact that, you know, once you know that was his intention, that style then makes sense.
Right? Yeah, because it's interesting because in the... So the movies are different in terms of their fantasies from the movie, the 1980s film and this one. The 1980s film, it's almost like a World War II movie where, you know, they're fighting fascists and stuff. This one kind of, but that was a different, and it wasn't as colorful. This one, they wanted to feel the escape of from the grim gray lives that they're in now, and they transfer to a colorful world, which they claim is Technicolor in it, but I would have liked to have felt that Technicolor-ness.
One thing I really did feel was the color. And I'm looking forward to screening that.
Yeah.
Because that color is so lovely and bright.
Yeah, pops, right.
But yeah, it's worth a chat. It's worth a watch. It's worth knowing it exists. It's nice knowing that such a seasoned veteran is behind this decision making and is making it. But yeah, as you said, it did receive some mixed reviews, and so that is what it is. But it's nice that we are screening it.
Cool.
We are hitting the ground running this year.
Nice.
With that Rental Family, which just looks so warm and happy, and I think that's going to be such a slow burner of sorts, because I don't think it's a big film everybody knows about.
Yeah.
But this is Brendan Fraser's sort of film after The Whale. I don't know whether he's done.
Technically, it was Killers of the Flower Moon.
Killers of the Flower Moon. But, you know, this is what are we calling it? The Renaissance.
Renaissance.
There's some name for it. But his return to, you know, Hollywood movies again. And but this is set in Japan.
Yeah.
I'm lucky enough to have traveled a lot to Japan, so I can attest to just how strange and weird it is when there are these beautiful, odd jobs and things that exist. This is a nation that can get very lonely, despite being the most populated, biggest city in the world. So a city like Tokyo has places like cuddle cafes and conversation cafes, which aren't the sort of weird sexual things of the West. It's more emotional and connection, where these male, effectively male prostitutes, but they're not, it doesn't feel weird and sexual, but you see a lot of these headshots of handsome boys outside these cafes, and they are effectively these men that you can hire to just like talk to you and kind of be your boyfriend.
Right.
Which is so fascinating. Because anything that happens in Japan now is what we're going to do in about 5 to 10 years' time. Yeah. Same with fashion, same with a whole bunch of tech choices. They are the most efficient nation in the world. So whatever they've done is not over the top or ridiculous or convoluted like it often is in America. This is efficiency. So like humanity will head in this direction. And so Brendan Fraser is an actor who's done things like sort of toothpaste ads and gets hired to work effectively as a actor for different people's lives, where you effectively become a member of a family that they rent, and you fulfill that role. So you could be the husband or you could be the father, and you paid to be an actor.
Yeah,
I think everybody knows. I don't think anyone's duped. Maybe a little kid might be, but everybody knows what the transaction is.
Yeah,
and I think it'll turn into the most heartwarming film and a real gooey one. So I'm looking forward to seeing it, because in the December chaos, there wasn't any exhibitor screening.
Yeah.
But it starts this weekend.
Cool.
So hopefully we'll just be able to watch it at the Bioscope, because that'll be my chance to watch it. But it just, it's one of those where, for me, not having seen it, I could just tell from other reviews and just trailers, like, this just looks like a great movie.
Nice.
So we picked that. But then, just to, because I want to talk about Marty Supreme, and then I want to end on Stranger Things.
Cool.
Marty Supreme is the other big one.
Yeah.
That also starts this weekend at the Bioscope. It's been out for 1 week already, where you Perrin had a chance to watch it.
That's right.
Can you tell us what you think?
Loved it. So this is from Josh Safdie. Yeah. So it's obviously the Safdie brothers. Benny did, let me just double
Smashing
check.
Machine.
Yeah, Benny did the Smashing Machine with The Rock. And
but I just love how the Safdie brothers have split up.
Yeah.
And the Coen brothers have split up.
Yeah.
Yet the Russo brothers are back making cut movies.
Yeah.
And the Duffer brothers are
doing their thing,
making television.
So
I
saw a meme that was like the good ones split up and the bad ones. Yeah,
exactly. That's what I'm hinting at.
So pretty much it's very loosely based on a table tennis guy from like the 50s, 60s, and like he had quite a prominent career, American guy. Very loosely based on him. And essentially what it's about is, so Timothée Chalamet plays this guy named Marty Mauser,
Marty Mauser.
And he is a table tennis hotshot, goes to the British Open. He, like, is dominant, but then he loses at the last hurdle.
Right.
And what's happening now is that the World Championships is coming up in Japan, which in the movie they talk about how, like, well, the travel ban's over because it's set in 1952, so it's fresh after the war. So now Japan, obviously, table tennis, as we know, is huge in Asia, like massive. So this is like a shock to all the West system. They're like, whoa, okay, these guys are like serious. So now Marty Mauser, because he's a bit of a, let's just say he's a terrible person.
Yeah, he's a hustler.
He's a grifter, right?
Right.
So he works part-time as a shoe salesman. So obviously he's not earning a lot professionally from this. That's where he earns his money from winning these tournaments, right? But now because he's stacked up a huge bill to pay towards the table tennis association that he owes them, he has to get that money together as well as get money to go play the World Championships in Japan. And the film is a series of events of him making terrible decisions to try get there. And it falls in line with the perfect. So the interesting thing about The Smashing Machine from Benny Safdie is that it doesn't have that anxious, chaotic, always moving energy that Good Time and Uncut Gems had, right?
Which was when the two brothers were working together.
So it feels like you can already tell the different styles. Smashing Machine has some of that style there, but it's a lot more restrained. It's a slower moving movie, right?
Yeah.
Whereas Marty Supreme, it looks like Josh Safdie was the one that exhibited all that. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And this movie, like I said, is just that whole trilogy. What I love about those films is that All three of them are essentially these hustlers. They're grifters. They're terrible people.
What is the trilogy?
It's Good Time, Uncut Gems, and now Marty Supreme.
And now Marty Supreme.
And they make consistently awful decisions that just make their decisions, their things worse and worse. Nice. And these characters all share the same, these protagonists all share the same quality in that they are trying to get success quick. You know what I mean? They're trying to find reasons to redeem themselves by, like in Uncut Gems, selling this opal, this black opal that he gets, and, you know, getting all this money to pay off all his problems, right? Yeah. But then he's just...
There's no long plan.
Yeah, he's just digging the hole even worse, you know? Yeah. Then Good Time, he's trying to get his brother back out of this, like, facility, but he's just making it worse and worse for himself and his brother, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And with this, it's just he's making things worse for his mother at home, his girlfriend that he's seeing, and it's just such a thrilling film. There's the soundtrack is so good. They mostly use 80s music in it.
Cool. Right.
And the it's the same composer. His music name is 10 Tricks Point Never. He's a like an ambient electronic musician. And yeah, the score is just pulsating. It's just a frantic movie. Timothée Chalamet is a piece of shit in it. He's so good. Abel Ferreira, if you know that name, he's a prominent filmmaker from the 70s. I'd say he was the guy under the radar when this mostly the 80s when Scorsese and them were coming up. He did Bad Lieutenant with Harvey Keitel.
Oh yeah.
He plays like a sketchy, like we think like a mob guy in it, and he's so freaking good in it. But that whole cast is phenomenal. That what I love about the Safdies as well, they are good at, like the PTA, they do well finding non-actors as well.
Right.
And just they feel so natural in their roles. Like it's so hard to make a non-actor just get it. Mm. And that's what the Safdies do so well. That's what I love about the Safdies as well, is that they make films that feel like gritty New York from the 70s.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Good Time felt like gritty
Giuliani.
No. What's it when you are you building Starbuckses and stuff in
pre-gentrification.
Yeah, it feels like New York pre-gentrification. Right. So like Good Time, Uncut Gems, these are all grimy New York pictures. Mm. And Marty Supreme is a grimy New York picture
A lovely example of what you're trying to describe was something very cool to hear with The Holdovers, where the set's in the 70s, and the guy was like, the challenge is you got to fill the street with 1970s cars.
Yeah.
But he's like, but not pristine, crisp new ones, because those are the ones that are left in showrooms and people's collections. Mm. You've got to make them look shit, because in the 70s, they looked a little bit shit.
Yeah.
You know, they got to have a little bit of wear and tear on them.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just a great movie. I think it's a front. It's the big three for the Oscars, the big four. Yeah,
So let me guess what your four are. Obviously, Marty Supreme, One Battle After Another, Sinners, and then I don't know what your fourth
Hamnet.
Is. Hamnet. Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So, yeah, I think after just, because I watched it with Kira, and literally the first lines of the movie from Timothée Chalamet, she turns to me, she's like, fuck, he's amazing. And like, there's performances like that, like same with Emma Stone in Poor Things. The moment you see her on screen, you're like, holy shit, she's incredible. And with Timothée Chalamet in this is his best performance.
Okay.
It's his best performance at least since Call Me By Your Name. And he's just, there's certain roles where you forget that you're watching an actor. You know what I mean? And this, he's just so effortless in this character. He famously, I know he worked hard actually trying, like learning to play like a professional table tennis.
He was playing ping pong on the set of Dune.
Yeah.
And he said he got into some heated games with the bodyguard, the guy who was sort of maintaining the fort in the Abu Dhabi camp.
Right.
Oh, cool.
on set of Dune.
Yeah. And I mean, like, it's just, you feel that passion in the film. And I, look, I haven't seen Secret Agent yet, which is Wagner Moura. He is the dark horse for best actor.
Okay.
And he plays multiple characters in that movie. So, but the moment after watching this, I'm like, he has my vote, Timothée Chalamet.
But, the thing is, if it is a really deserving role, Chalamet is the famous one. He's the one that people know of.
Yeah.
And I mean, and so it does become a little bit of a popularity vote.
Yeah. The only thing that could sour voters is the campaign blitz that they're going on. Because I mean, it didn't work for Unknown. A complete unknown. And I thought it was going to work. But I mean, it's just when you're good, you're good. And Timothée Chalamet, I know a lot of people, for some reason, it's popular to hate on him. I think he's fucking charming. He's a cool dude.
I'm not even feeling that happening. And, he's
supremely talented because I know Cole's also a big fan. And like, it's just such a fucking great performance. It's a role of a lifetime. It'll be so sad not to see him win at least some awards for it. Right. You know what I mean? Because with the Bob Dylan one, he only won one leading up to it. Which one was that? I think it was the Critics' Choice Award. SAG.
You're right.
And that he gave such a great acceptance speech for that. He basically announced, he's like, I'm here for a long time, not a good time. It was like, he said something like, I want to be one of the greats.
Yeah, exactly. And people gave him shit for that, but like...
He got my respect for that.
No, I agree, because I mean...
It was him going like, I acknowledge... You know, where I come from, what's the world I'm in, and I want to be one of the main guys. And it's
I like the honesty of that speech because, like you say, I mean, why would you, if getting into the industry, into film and stuff, of course you want to be a great. You don't want to be some guy in the background.
But
you
just
know?
Acknowledging that there's a long game. And I think a musician like Youngblood is also very good at doing that.
Yeah.
Like whenever he sort of speaks about, you know, where he's come from, and he's just the young pup, but you know, these heroes, these are the people he wants to be like, and sort of acknowledges the fact that they're these other people, where you tend to see a new generation go like, remember there was that song with Paul McCartney and Rihanna?
Oh my God. It was Kanye West.
And it was like that sort of acoustic-y jam.
Yeah, people were like, that's so nice.
And people were like, wow, whoever this Paul McCartney guy is, like, he's getting real famous with this song.
Yeah, they
and
were like, it's so nice.
So like painful to hear that.
These
shit.
Kids are like, Kanye is such a good dude for like bringing up this unknown talent. And it's like,
and it's the same as there's also another channel of this dude going, and his whole channel is dedicated to Gen Z. Kid listens to, you know, whoever for the first time.
Right.
And you're just like, well, fuck off, man.
Yeah, it's like the most famous album ever.
And it's like, sure, we can move past it and there can be other greats, but it's like, you can't not have listened to this.
I saw just an example I saw on Facebook where someone posted like the most high def movie I've ever seen is from 1968 and he's talking about 2001. And then someone commented saying, like, I love this movie so much, I thought no one cared about it. And all the comments were like, oh, yeah, it's just from some obscure talent named Kubrick, you know? Never heard. I commented, like, too obscure, don't care. I don't want to even try to find it, you know?
Yeah.
But it's crazy how, like, we forget that young kids are still discovering this stuff. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's wild to us that it's wild to me that like people would be like, who the fuck is Robbie Williams when A Better Man came out?
Yeah.
And we're like, are you joking? Like he was everywhere in the 90s, you know?
Yeah. You almost just got to hold some respect for it. That's all.
Yeah.
Just be like, okay. And maybe I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, but I can at least understand it comes from a place.
Yeah, of course.
Just as Kylie Jenner came up, I had a debate with someone as to who was the more famous Kylie between this newly minted Kylie against Kylie Minogue. And I was like, I don't even think you can comprehend how big Kylie Minogue is because she's just had decades of songs and
iconic
movies and all sorts. Anyways, speaking of what could be a modern classic, we have just completed Stranger Things. G-Force, how do you feel
I
coming
out
the end of it?
Fine.
Okay.
I think it's okay. I don't want to get into it too much because it's still fresh, so I don't want
to
spoil things.
It needs
things.
A little bit of time to sort of sit.
Yeah, exactly, for people to actually watch it. But I think it's perfectly fine. I think the reaction to it has been very reactionary.
Sure.
Yeah, like especially people, considering it's the final.
Exactly.
Hurdle.
People made up their minds about it before, like, even seeing the final episode.
Mm.
And just started posting about that online. And it's just like, I'm sick of the discourse already, and it's been out for a few days.
Could you have seen how it was going to end? Or was it, because I can speak completely objectively, or did it give you something right at the end? Or did it swing in a way that you didn't see coming?
Not really. It kind of does exactly what you expect it's going to do.
Okay.
Honestly, but that's like, also, there's no big surprises.
In a way, that's
okay. But
that's
okay. Also not a bad thing for a series finale.
Exactly. For a show that's been going for 10 years.
Yeah.
I don't think you want to pull the rug out from your audience at the last second.
Because people have learned just how fucking detrimental that could be.
I was going to say this because people are comparing it to Game of Thrones. I'm like, no, it's nothing like the end of Game of Thrones. Nothing.
Yeah. Game of Thrones is a rug pull, but not in a good way. Like, I think one of the most underrated finales ever is the Sopranos finale.
Oh, right.
Like, the way that ended, people were upset because it was only it was only a 42-minute long episode, and people thought the power went out when it ended. And I think the way it ended, spoiler alert.
It's been many years.
Yeah, spoiler alert. It's literally Tony Soprano's with his family. They're at a diner. Journey's Don't Stop Believing is playing in the background. Mm. People are coming into the diner. The bell rings and stuff. And eventually the bell rings and it cuts to black. He looks up and it cuts to black. And the whole idea of that is that my theory is that he dies. Right.
Right.
So it just cuts because Bobby, one of the characters in a few episodes prior, was talking about what do you think it's like when you die? And he says, I think it just cuts to black. It just ends. And I think it's such a perfect finale because that episode, David Chase is one of the most underrated creators in terms of metaphors and stuff like that. The dream sequences in Sopranos meant so much going forward.
Yeah.
And this final episode, there was so much in every frame that was like, oh, that's foreshadowing, or this means this, or this.
It sounds like it pretty much was that.
Yeah.
But it still leaves a little bit of room, which is interesting.
Yeah. I know. So with this last season, so I mentioned to you earlier, I found this season to be such a slog. I'm struggling to get to the finish.
Could have all these very long episodes been indulgent?
I think so. I think also it doesn't help that they took a break for so long. Like, I feel like the me caring about it coming back withered.
That's a big part of the TV shows these days, is that because we're getting this epic television that isn't on a studio set where these guys have a 9-to-5 and then they can maybe take a little break and then come back to work.
Mm-hmm.
Something like Pluribus, which has come to an end, which we can maybe touch on. A big part of the discussion now is like, okay, we've seen enough of this epic television, Severance and all of these, where it's like, okay, how long is it going to take for another season?
Wow.
And will we give a fuck about it?
But that's my biggest worry. When I was in high school and like, so Lost was my favorite show when I was like, when that came out. And I remember there was a joke in Kick-Ass where towards the end where Aaron Taylor-Johnson's character is like,
oh yeah, forget he was in that.
Yeah, where he like, I think he gets the shit beaten out of him and he's like, he thinks he's going to die. And in his head, he's like the voiceover. He's like, I'm not going to know what happened to them in Lost. Like, and that was my fear as a kid, was like, fuck, I hope I don't die before the Lost finale comes out. So like, that's for me with like Severance. I don't want to wait too long. Like with Breaking Bad, when it ends, it's like so perfect the way it ended. You know what I mean?
Well,
and I don't want to not know how things end before it ends. You know what I mean? Like with Stranger Things, like normally I would have been like racing to the finish line. This one I'm like, oh, and I've seen countless reels and stuff of people talking about their frustrations with this latest season, is that every scene feels like a, wait, okay, guys, let's discuss what we just learned. Okay, so the Upside Down is actually a cell phone, and the cell phone is actually broken in half, and it's actually in a hamburger, and the hamburger is Will. You know, like, it's like that kind of stuff where okay. It's just like, oh, and it just gets so exhausting. I know Cole posted it as well. He's like, it's exhausting.
I think part of it is you get a show like Lost where people were annoyed that they didn't explain everything.
Exactly.
So in this, they now feel, okay, wait, we have to explain everything and wrap everything up. Jeez, otherwise, like, people are going to be pissed off.
But that's the problem as well. Like, that's what I loved about The Leftovers, which was Damon Lindelof post-Lost. And he said with The Leftovers, he made it in a way that he learned his lesson from Lost. Like, initially, Lost was supposed to be like 4 seasons. Mm-hmm. But because it was such a smash, ABC was like, nope, we want as many as we can. And they ended up writing too many mysteries they couldn't solve. And in season 2 and 3 of The Leftovers, perfect show, it's my favorite show of all time. The title sequence, the music, they even say, I guess I'll just let the mystery be. Mm. And it's okay not to know the mysteries because that's how life is. I don't know how the pyramids were really built. You know, I don't know who, we'll probably never know what really happened with JFK. You know, like stuff like that. Like sometimes we'll just have to let the mystery be.
Maybe with something like Pluribus, I get it. It needed to prove itself. Yeah. It was such a big swing.
So good. Jesus.
The audience was there, and it was the most watched show on Apple TV. Yeah. So now the
until
dude...
Until Severance.
Well, since.
No, but until season 3.
Until Severance season 3. But now we know that he's got a plan.
Yeah.
So provided everyone buys in on the plan, he should make it all.
Yeah.
But that's...
Like back-to-back almost and release it sort of... Take the breaks, but maybe that's the quicker way to do it.
For me, like, that's what I loved about Damon Lindelof is what his thought process going forward, especially with The Leftovers. So there were 3 seasons of that, but each season, the way they ended, that could have been the finale, and I'd be happy with
it. Well, that's just smart writing.
You see, like, that's what I hate cliffhangers because we've been burnt in the past from that.
Yeah.
Euphoria season 2, the British one, ended on the biggest cliffhanger and the show got canned. And get that.
No, we all know that.
That's
frustration.
Cuck, you know?
What I really enjoy is a good old limited series.
Yeah, love it.
And so it is worth mentioning, we are waist deep in the new Harlan Coben on Netflix,
right?
Which is called Gone Away. And Harlan Coben is definitely worth a mention. He's one of the more prolific thriller book writers. Somewhat pulpy, but not silly.
Mm.
Like smart, thought through mystery crime stories that are fucking perfect for limited series.
Mm.
Like they would make bad movies in that you would, you know,
you wouldn't have enough time.
No.
And so he signed this like this 10 picture deal with Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And they've banged out a bunch of them. We've spoken about them on the show. But Gone Away is just great. It's one of those fucking unravelers. And there should just be enough. And I think the sweet spot is 6 to 8, any more than 8.
Yeah.
And then you know there's going to be a cuck, boring episode in the middle
that's
going to fill some space. But we are halfway through. We're 4 out of 8. And it's toit. And there are... whole bunch of secrets and whole bunch of things. Basically, the story is a dad in this family who's looking for his daughter who left home and became a drug addict and all sorts, but is embroiled in a whole bunch of things. And all these mysteries are coming out and all these secrets are coming out and interweaving people. And it's great.
Cool.
It's good television. And I just think that prime spot is the limited series.
Right.
We're not expecting to ever come back to these characters, but like you really get a bit more meat on the bone.
Right. Who's in it?
No one of huge substance. You might recognize one or two faces. Oh, Minnie Driver's the mom.
Oh, cool. Okay.
But yeah, British, great, lovely, ooh. Gone Away.
Nice.
And then what is interesting is the book of the festive season was Harlan Coben teaming up with Reese Witherspoon.
Oh, cool.
To make a book called Gone Before Goodbye.
Yes.
So which gone is the...
Yeah, gone seems to be the words. But, you know, it was a big hit in terms of a book for Christmas this year.
Mm.
Between my family, about 3 of them have read it. Les...
Beach read.
Yeah, no, 100%.
Yeah.
And Les was like, it's good. So I think what happened, and I've listened to a conversation with Reese Witherspoon, she had the idea.
Right.
So she had the story, but she can't sit and write.
Mm.
You know, maybe for time and maybe for just general grammar.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The art of actually writing. So you seeing this a bit, Keanu Reeves teamed up with China Mielville.
Yeah.
Mielville? How do you pronounce his name?
I have no idea.
Mielville. And they made a book together, and now this is Reese Witherspoon.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Now this is Reese Witherspoon, you know, teaming up with, like, arguably the biggest crime thriller writer operating today.
Mm.
So we'll see a TV show for this, fucking doubt.
Cool.
Because she also produces her own stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably, I mean, it's crazy. You get, every now and then you get the movie deal before the book's even completed. And that's what happened with Mickey 17.
Yeah, no, crazy. But of course, this has been Reese Witherspoon's little sweet spot, is that she's created this, like, book club.
Yeah.
She makes these books famous because she's optioned them to be movies. And so she's picked the good ones, owned them, publicized them, and then gets the deal later, you know, when they make it. But lacquer, guys.
Yeah.
Is there anything else to mention at this point?
No.
Otherwise, I think we've had ourselves a lovely day at work.
Yeah.
It is really good to be back. And it is just lacquer. Let's make 2026 a good year for us.
Let's do it.
Lots of good movies.
Yeah.
Okay. Magic.
Nice.
Thanks, guys.
Cool.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.